Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Gregory Melville and Susan Fox and Kathleen Bromage.
This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can always join our conversation on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. We're going to welcome in this week Harriet Jones. She's managing editor at Connecticut Public Radio. Hello there, Harriet.
Good morning, John.
Also with us is Mark Pazniokas, Capitol Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror. Hello there, Paz.
Good morning.
And Daniela Altomare, State House reporter for the Hartford Courant. Thank you so much for coming in, Daniela.
Thank you.
Colin McEnroe is away. He'll be back next week. We've got a lot to talk about at the Capitol this week. And I don't know, I said this in the start of the show, in the billboard, Daniela and Paz, it seemed like kind of an ugly week at the Capitol for some reason. There's a lot of strangeness. We're going to get to some name calling, but maybe we'll start with what's happening with this new grocery tax. There's supposed to be a new 7.35% tax on prepared foods that's set to start October 1st. But it seems as though that was interpreted much more broadly by members of the administration than others. And so a whole lot of stuff that wasn't supposed to get that tax got taxed. Do I have that right?
You had that right. And the governor's office first defended it and then basically threw DRS under the bus yesterday. I asked the governor, did DRS run this interpretation by his office before they published it? And he just said, no, frankly, no. So this has become something of, I don't know if it's more than a tempest in a teacup, but it seems to be something that's become a large controversy over applying the sales tax to prepared meals. And the Republicans are holding yet another press conference today. They have been hammering away. The governor's office said, we're going to fix it. It's a question of DRS, that's the Department of Revenue Services, how they interpreted a perhaps inartfully written state law, which happens from time to time.
Well, it does happen from time to time, but just walk this through, Daniela, for people who don't spend time at the Capitol or read every single story about Republican press conferences around the Capitol. I mean, what are we talking about here? What's the difference between what we might think of as prepared foods and non-prepared foods? What's supposed to be taxed?
I guess the tax department that Paz was referencing interpreted this in a way that both the legislators and the governor say wasn't intended. For instance, they want to apply this tax to things like rotisserie chicken that you might buy at Stop and Shop, or bagged lettuce, or a single-serve ice cream bar. It starts to become really cumbersome. You can just imagine, you know, at checkout how this would work and the headaches it would cause. It also really touches a nerve with people. I mean, that's why we're seeing, you know, Republican press conference after Republican press conference, because this is like a really powerful symbolic issue, I think, for people, and a real issue because, you know, obviously they'd be paying more money. But
I mean, there are two things here. The restaurant tax went up a point.
Yeah, and that's not going to change.
That's not going to change. And then the idea was, in the governor's words, well, we're going to try to have it a level playing field. So if you're selling a sandwich in a restaurant, you got to pay 7.35% tax. If you buy the same sandwich at Stop and Shop, you should pay the tax. So the idea was quite simple. It's the execution that's getting a little complicated.
Yeah, because once you start opening up that whole universe of things, I mean, grocery stores sell a lot of things. What's prepared food and what's, you know, not? I mean, it's really complicated.
Well, I think also, Harriet, it gets to this point of most people, I think, probably don't spend a whole lot of time thinking about public policy and whether or not the tax rate is going to be this or that when they go to the checkout counter. They may notice a little rise in their grocery bill, but they're not going to say, oh my goodness, I'm not buying that anymore because of it's 6.5 versus 7.5. I think the problem comes when people don't even know about it, and then it gets told to them in this kind of a ham-handed way that doesn't make any sense, and now everyone's paying attention to it in a way that they weren't going to pay attention to it before.
Right. I think, you know, a tax on groceries is kind of a watermark, if you like, you know, in a state where people are quite often exercised about the taxes that they pay. The fact, you know, of starting to pay taxes on groceries seems to be, you know, kind of a red line, and this is I think the Republicans saw an opportunity to point that out, that this was kind of a creep into, you know, having to pay taxes on your groceries.
And let's be very careful. And this is where you get into weirdness with sales tax on definitions. You know, they're not talking about what most people would think of as their groceries, right? Food at grocery stores, by and large, is still tax exempt. There have always been things at grocery stores that you got to pay a tax on.
Sure.
You know, so it's you know, it's a question of them getting their computer system to sort of connect it. But this is food. It's so I guess you get into a semi-philosophical discussion
right,
of when does
right.
the grocery yeah. become a prepared meal?
I mean, a rotisserie chicken is a prepared meal that you could sit down and eat. It's also an ingredient in a lot of things that people yeah. make. Like you make a chicken salad, you might buy a rotisserie chicken. So what? So why is it, you know, I mean, it gets really complicated.
Well, and I'm having a flashback to 1989, before the state of Connecticut had an income tax, and they were desperate to balance the budget. So they were, what do? You had the sales tax was the big workhorse. So they were expanding the sales tax, and you got into these bizarre debates. So one of them was, they were going to tax seeds. And there was this very funny debate of somebody got up on the House floor and said, you know, we're getting into this difficult area of the legislature is trying to do what the theologist and whatnot have never done is to define once and for all, when does food begin?
Well, you know, and I think it's in a lot of ways, Harriet, at some of these press conferences with, you know, Republican lawmakers holding up rotisserie chickens, it can be a point of comedy, but it speaks a bit to bad politics, maybe in some people's minds, bad policy, but it really does start to make us question a lot about, okay, where are we headed with taxes on the things that we use here? And does this start to really become very regressive? I mean, the $3 rotisserie chicken is a main food source for a lot of people. Let's just put it that way.
All right. And your bagged lettuce, too. I mean,
absolutely.
Know, I'm not sure how much of an argument there is to be made that that's a sort of prepared meal. But I thought the other really interesting thing about this is
the ones with croutons.
Okay. Is that the line
yeah.
for you?
Croutons? Yeah.
Dressing. We don't often get to see this world of how a law that's passed actually gets then interpreted. It gets turned into guidelines and then it's implemented by the people to whom it applies. And this is actually the second time this year that this kind of process has been, you know, there's been a spotlight shone on this process of agencies writing guidelines for people who have to implement laws. And the time before was the veto that Governor Lamont issued this summer on a bill which was to do with the way that the minimum wage law is interpreted by restaurants for tipped wage workers. And again, the Department of Labor was kind of thrown under the bus there for having written this guidance, which legislators on both sides, both Republicans and Democrats, said, well, the Department of Labor wrote this guidance on applying the minimum wage to tip workers, which is just wrong. And it had sparked a bunch of lawsuits. So, you know, again, we're kind of seeing this. How does a law actually get implemented in the real world? And who's responsible for writing that guidance?
And there's a political lesson here. So economists on the left and right actually agree on something with the sales tax. The sales tax should be as broad as possible. It should cover everything you can think of and at the lowest possible rate. And that's the best public policy. The political problem with that is every time you expand the sales tax base, it is a huge fight. And the political capital one expands, whether you're a governor or a legislative leader, is just enormous. And this is a reminder of why we have, you know, it's always a very funky list. What is taxable? What isn't?
But when it comes to the political fight, though, Daniela, I think one thing that the Lamont administration maybe is missing as an opportunity. This is when Republican lawmakers stand up and say, "Look, he wants to, you know, tax your rotisserie chicken. He wants to tax your bagged lettuce. He wants to toll your highways." There is, in theory, an opening for on the left for something that a whole lot of people have been calling for, which is, okay, we're going to find this taxes somewhere else, and that probably is going to come from people's income, and we're going to go back into that other very murky political water and try to figure out how to do that. And this governor, I don't think, has that in mind. I don't think this is something he wants to do.
No, he doesn't want to do that. So, you know, then that becomes a fight between the Democrats who want to do that, the progressive Democrats who want to do that, and the Lamont and his allies, the more centrist Democrats who don't. So they don't. That's not an argument they want to have with the Republicans.
Now, you had mentioned earlier that the area underneath the bus perhaps has gotten a bit crowded. We talked last week about Renee Coleman Mitchell, the commissioner of the Department of Public Health, coming out publicly and saying she was not going to release school-by-school vaccination data. And then very, very quickly after that, the Lamont administration saying, no, we really want you to do that. This week, we're also talking about another related issue about repealing religious exemptions for vaccines. Governor Lamont pledged to eliminate the religious exemption for vaccinating school children. Reading a quote here from the Hartford Courant, we're going to have hearings. We're going to do it in a respectful way. We're going to do it because it's a public health issue. And as your governor, public safety and public health are two of my honestly overwhelming responsibilities. So this is another big controversy here.
Yeah, I thought that was a very interesting quote. We're going to do it respectfully with hearings, but we're going to do it. Seems like, okay.
I think because last year it came up, as you remember this too, I think as far as I can remember, it came up kind of late in the session. There was an informational hearing, but I don't recall an actual public hearing at the committee level on it. So it's kind of the process that they went about this. And the opponents of this change seized on that and said, you're trying to ram it in at the last minute. And also the governor really didn't sort of get out in front of it. He was always in favor. He's not he has never expressed, an unwillingness to eliminate this religious exemption. But he's never really been, you know, sort of holding press conferences and demanding it until this week.
He said this time, I will take the lead. Mm-hmm. And Danielle is right. The point about the hearing is that it was a broader statement that last time was outside the committee process. The committee deadlines had passed. So that's really what they're signaling here about it being respectful. But yes, there is the governor, the legislative leaders of the House and Senate Democratic caucuses are firmly behind this, saying that the public health data indicates this is a problem. We now have more than 100 schools. And that was of some older data. We're going to get newer data, which indicates that the issues become broader, in which you no longer have that magical 95% herd immunity number. And this is how, this is how you get outbreaks of measles and other contagious diseases.
But does this speak to another kind of divide within the administration? I think part of the reason that the Department of Public Health wasn't too keen to release these statewide numbers was because they said basically statewide we're doing pretty well. We're vaccinated at a pretty high level. This seems to be reversing that note from the administration saying, no, actually, it's a big statewide problem. We're going to make sure this religious exemption applies to everybody.
I think it speaks to the Commissioner of Public Health.
Or doesn't apply to everybody. Excuse me. Yes.
I think it speaks directly to her reluctance to get involved in this. I don't think this represents a wider division at the Department of Public Health or within the administration. She had a very odd view of what her job is. I asked her directly one day, do you see part of your job as going out to the public, specifically going to the Connecticut General Assembly when they're looking for scientific guidance, for health guidance? And she said no. She did not believe that was her job. It seems, has had a come to Jesus moment, and that moment may have occurred in the governor's office. But she was very strong. She found her voice the other day standing in the governor's office with all these people, and she unequivocally said, this is good public policy. She is supporting it, and she will go to the legislature, and she will so testify.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting kind of culture wars moment, I guess, for Lamont, in that I think, the polling would probably show that a vast majority of people in Connecticut would support his position that we should have mandatory vaccination. But there is an extremely, extremely vocal minority, and we did see them come out at the press conference this week, who say, no, it should be my choice whether to vaccinate my child. So it's going to be interesting to see how he messages to those people and how he pushes this through.
I think Senator Looney, Martin Looney, had a good response to that question, where the parents, you know, were holding up signs saying "My child, my choice," and you know, his response to that is, "No, it's actually not your choice." But regardless of the wider public health concerns that Paz just laid out, there's also this idea that it isn't you don't get to choose for your child when it comes to health and safety. I mean, the state has a role, and children. I think his quote was, "Children aren't chattel," and I thought that was a really sort of powerful way of framing this, that, you know, you can't decide something for your child if that is contrary to the child's best interest. I thought that was kind of interesting.
I want to move on to next issue, another bugaboo for the Lamont administration since the start. So far, his governorship has been defined in large part by the debate over tolls. It's something that people want to continually bring up. He hasn't been able to pass through any sort of large tolls plan, as we've talked about. There have been rumblings coming through the administration about what is next in terms of how they're going to finance this. I was told in no uncertain terms that they did not roll out any sort of plan yet. But Paz, you're reporting that there is perhaps a plan coming for transportation funding sometime soon.
Yes, the governor's chief of staff has taken the lead over the summer in developing what they're calling CT 2030, a 10-year plan. I think it's going to be in the neighborhood of $20 billion. They're trying to make the case for what the state needs, what the priorities should be, and then have the debate and the discussion of saying, okay, if we all can agree on this, how do we now pay for it? So one of the things they're doing, they've been trying to maximize federal dollars. I'm not sure the feds, again, have this incredible pot of money that's going to be life-changing. But you know, they've been talking to what the United States Department of Transportation calls its Build America Bureau. It's one-stop shopping for a variety of different financing programs. There are representatives of the Build America Bureau who are coming to Hartford on Friday to give a presentation to a select group of legislators, you know, the people on the Transportation Committee, the various leaders. Part of that will be, are there alternatives to tolling? Perhaps not to completely avoid tolling, but perhaps to minimize the tolling that they need to do.
I don't know. Here it is. As we look at this, again, I'm making very clear here. They've not rolled out a plan.
They have not.
I said last week that they rolled out a plan, and I was told they haven't rolled out a plan. A plan is rolling, I suppose, at some point. But what do we make of this plan that has not yet been
rolled
out?
They're going to drag it out. They're not going to roll it out.
I think it's – I mean – again, politically for Lamont, this is another moment where, you know, it's kind of an opening for the Republicans to say, well, hold on a second, you were all, you know, full speed ahead on tolls, but you hadn't gone and asked the feds what money they have. Come on, you know, we should be, you know, looking in other people's pockets before we look in our own, might be the line for the Republicans. So, again, you know, how much money there is at the federal level will be an interesting thing to see.
Well, I think the problem for Republicans then is they might have to answer to a federal government run by a Republican administration that doesn't seem to have much of a plan in terms of how they are going to distribute this funding to the states.
You mean it isn't Infrastructure Week? Are you sure?
I thought it was Infrastructure Week again.
Well, but let's be clear. There are a couple of things here. There are existing finance programs in which the feds are loaning the money. It's not the $1.8 trillion or $2 trillion infrastructure investment that the president has been in favor of, then he's not been in favor of, and now they're going to have another meeting in Washington to see really what's there. The House Democrats in Washington are four square behind that. They know they can't get it through the Senate without the president. So that's a whole other thing. Will there be this, you know, moonshot program on infrastructure spending by the feds? What they're going to be talking about Friday is stuff that is there. It's these programs with, you know, the wonderful acronyms, you know, TIFIA, the Transportation Infrastructure Finance something, blah, 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 RIF, the Railroad Infrastructure Fund. And these are programs that are putting money out. One of these programs is incredibly selective. It's the railroad one. It's like two grants a year. You know, Amtrak got $2.5 billion. But again, you're borrowing – generally, you're borrowing from them. Connecticut historically has not gone there because they've gotten better rates. in the bond market. The question is now, can you get a better deal there? They can defer payments. They can, you know, so there are, again, this gets in the weeds pretty damn fast.
It gets in the weeds, and it's just but it's such an interesting issue because we've been talking about transportation, Daniela, not in the weeds at all up until this point. It's, you know, we got a toll in order to make sure that we have the money to pay for these crumbling roads and bridges. And now we're down the weeds here.
Yeah, and I don't think it's clear at all that whatever plan they roll out or drag out or whatever is not going to have tolls. I mean, I think tolls most likely probably will have some kind of a role. There won't be the, what was it, 54 gantries or whatever, because they tried that and that didn't work. But, you know, there's nothing that says if they go this route of pursuing federal dollars, tolls won't be somewhere in the state, some way, shape, or form.
And the other aspect here is the political one. You know, the governor is basically holding other bonding hostage. Good hardball politics. That's going to come to a head at some point this fall. The governor insisted the other day, I know how to negotiate, I know how to get to yes, and they'll work this out. But that's also going on behind the scenes.
I think what we're going to do here is we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about, well, at least how one leader of the GOP has characterized the governor's job so far, and talk a little bit about a war of words. Maybe it's a one-sided war at this point, and what it really means for governance at the state capitol. We're talking with Mark Pazniokas, Capitol Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror, Daniela Altomare, State House reporter for the Hartford Current, and Harriet Jones, Managing Editor here at Connecticut Public Radio. This is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news with Daniela Altomare from the Hartford Current, Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror, and our own Harriet Jones. Harriet, you're sitting in for Colin McEnroe today, who is away.
It's kind of a scary seat to fill, I will tell you.
It is a scary seat to fill. I will say I would normally ask Colin what's coming up on his show today, but I will ask you about something that's sort of new at Connecticut Public that I've been really excited about and that you've been working really hard on. We have a new newsletter that people can get.
Yes, we did. So newsletters are kind of all the rage. We have had one for several years, but it's been kind of an automated thing where we just threw a few stories in there. But we've actually started to kind of focus on our newsletter and make it into more of a curated item. And we have people working on it, people deciding, you know, in what order the stories will go. We're curating pictures into there, too. We're giving, you know, trying to give a kind of comprehensive look at the morning. And it's called Your Start. So it's the way that you can start the morning knowing everything that's going on Connecticut Public, but also, you know, taking in a kind of a good look at the important stories around Connecticut for the day. And I can tell you from the newsletter from this morning that on Colin's show today,
look at that.
What if you don't really enjoy food very much? Today, Colin will be taking a look at what you might call the non-foodie movement and the powdered meat replacement product that is Soylent. So there you go. News you can use from our newsletter.
Very good. The question we'll try to answer in the next half hour is are they taxing Soylent at a slightly higher level this year in Connecticut?
So just to close the loop, so go to WNPR.org, yes, and there is a sign-up button for our newsletter.
WNPR.org, that's where you can find this brand-new newsletter. It is a really good way to start the day. So,
wait a minute. That is the best segue I've heard in some time.
That's why they pay me the huge money. Let's go to the story that we were going to end the first segment with, but it sort of, in some ways, needs its own segment here. Governor Ed Lamont has been working very hard to call for bipartisan civility, and Themis Claridis, the House Republican leader, has said some things within the last couple of days that I think probably don't exactly meet that goal. I'm going to read a quote here. This is from a story in the Hartford Current. "Part of me feels badly for him because he's not a jerk, but he just can't do the job," Claridis said of Lamont. "That's the bottom line. He's incompetent to do this job. I'm sure there are other jobs he's done okay, but he just can't do this one." Okay, so Daniela, I mean, there's a lot of ways you can pull this apart. I mean, what do you make of that from a lot of different levels?
I guess, I don't know. I don't make too much of it. I don't think it's indicative of anything wider or bigger. You know, I remember last year during the gubernatorial election, a lot of talk was made about how Bob Stefanowski gave Trump an A rating or an A grade or something. And then we asked Lamont, well, you know, what kind of grade do you give Governor Malloy? And he said, oh, on fiscal issues, I give him an F. I mean, so, you know, that's just what they do. I don't know.
I guess I wonder though that felt like a harsh characterization, Paz.
It's harsher
perhaps than I've heard a Republican leader say of a Democratic governor, or the other way around.
Okay, a couple things to keep in mind. This was said at the Prescott Bush dinner. So this is a party fundraiser where it's kind of a clubby atmosphere. You're serving the proverbial red meat to the faithful.
And actually probably red meat too. But anyway,
undoubtedly.
Yeah.
Themis, the broader question is, you know, in the age of Trump, you know, I think people are more sensitive to the level of civil discourse. And do we have to get this nasty, this casually? I think that's kind of how the governor reacted to it. Themis Claridis loves to play hardball. She can be a little off color. She has challenged the masculinity of certain legislators by holding up a pair of baseballs and offering them as an image of asking, does somebody have a pair? This is not exactly out of character. The governor, since he has taken office, has put a great premium on trying to have Republicans in the room, of trying to have things have a bipartisan, at the very least, a bipartisan patina at times. So he seemed our colleague from The Current, Chris Keating, asked the governor about this, and the governor seemed genuinely hurt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he said, you know, I've worked really hard to change the tone of the building. It's been really tough for a number of years. I never try to personalize these things. We can disagree on policy, but we disagree respectfully. And then he said, so I think I still have some work to do with Themis.
I mean, that was my reaction, too, is that, you know, it's kind of Themis's stock in trade. Mm-hmm. She does, you know, her political persona is to call BS where she sees it, right? She, yeah. you know, stands up and, you know, comes out with these things. So it didn't strike me as completely out of character for her. I'm not sure. I think I'm with Danielle. I'm not sure how significant it really is.
Mm. Interesting. I will say that it does feel, though, perhaps if we were to wind this segment back several years before the start of the Trump administration, I think that maybe we might feel slightly different. I could be wrong. I know people have always said things about other people in politics that, you know, probably don't sound like the nicest thing to say on the playground, but I do feel like this is just a slippage perhaps in our overall discourse that probably wouldn't have sounded like this 10 years ago. Maybe I'm wrong about that.
Well, we did have the President of the United States in offering condolences on the death of Cokie Roberts, just mentioning, well, she was never very nice to me. So, I mean, that's where we are with the President.
It's important to bring it back to you always. Yes.
Yes.
Let's move on to another story. William Tong, the state attorney general, has been amongst the group of attorneys general around the country trying to get money back out of Purdue Pharma. Purdue Pharma, of course, the Stanford-based company where the family has made billions from selling, amongst other things, OxyContin. They are being held liable for that by many state attorneys general. And now they're filing bankruptcy. William Tong, Harriet, is basically saying, look, we might not be able to get the money that we need to be able to get out of them because of this bankruptcy filing. He wasn't happy with a settlement that many other attorneys general were happy to enter into with Purdue Pharma.
Yeah, so this is a move that has been, you know, signaled for months and months and months that Purdue would go into bankruptcy. It was just a question of when. It happened on Sunday night. And this settlement with about half the states, I think it's 23 of the states that are suing Purdue, have agreed in principle to the settlement, which is kind of rolled into the bankruptcy. So that's now what will be negotiated out in bankruptcy court. There are 25 states, including Connecticut, New York, Massachusetts, which have said, no, this settlement just, you know, even the broad outlines of the settlement are not good enough. And, you know, principally what's at stake for them is that they think it does not give them enough leeway to go after the Sacklers' personal wealth. So the Sackler family, or the family that privately own Purdue, have done for decades. They've made all kinds of money off of it. And they have the New York Attorney General says that they have drained money out of Purdue in recent recent months and salted it away in Swiss bank accounts. And the states that are not agreeing to the settlement say, we want the leeway to be allowed to pursue that money through the courts, because this, the money that they've offered in the settlement, between $10 and $12 billion, is not enough.
Mm. And this is, and Daniel, this is obviously a big deal, because this is a major initiative that William Tong and other attorneys general have undertaken, because it's trying to get at the heart of what is a gigantic problem, not only in Connecticut, but around the country. I mean, there are real downstream implications to the ways in which OxyContin and other opioids have been pushed on patients and pushed on the market for years.
Yeah, and there was a fascinating investigation done by the Associated Press on the very complex and kind of insidious ways that the Sacklers have kind of hidden their money, and they tried to sort of get at some of these strings of, you know, Swiss bank accounts and European estates in rural England, and, you know, really forming these holding companies, and just very, very complicated, very deliberate ways of, you know, stashing their wealth in places where regulators and folks like Attorney General Tong aren't able to get their hands on them.
Yeah, and it's one of several high-profile cases that William Tong has taken on so far. He's gotten quite the profile. I mean, he's obviously working with a lot of other colleagues, Paz, around the country on this and some other issues. But this is, you mentioned red meat before, this is certainly red meat for the new AG.
It is. An interesting angle is that William Tong is a former state representative from Stanford, the home of Purdue Pharma. This has not made him reluctant in the least to go after them. Purdue Pharma is an unusual target for this kind of thing, because it is privately held. You know, in this day and age of American capitalism, you do not see many multi-billion-dollar companies mm-hmm. that are family, you know, family operations, and which is why. It's more complex that if this was just a corporation that declared bankruptcy, the wall that goes up against litigation is pretty firm. Here, because there's family money, the Attorney Generals are saying, yeah, it's all intertwined, and that's what they're going at. You know, the Forbes estimates the Sacklers' family wealth at somewhere around $13 billion. There's some attorneys general who believe it's much more. Obviously there was the $1 billion that the New York Attorney General just tracked down that they had tucked away. So it's a different kind of litigation.
That's an interesting point about Tong, actually, because his predecessor, George Jepson, had taken a much softer approach. Connecticut was one of the very last states to actually sue Purdue, I think in part because it is a homegrown company. And I think perhaps the administration didn't like the optics of that. But George Jepson's rhetoric on this was much softer. And Tong came into office saying, no, we're going after them.
Part of that, I mean, the Massachusetts case where those documents were unsealed earlier this year, which showed, you know, the depths that the Sackler family individually went to hiding their methods and their ways of pushing this drug on the American public, on the medical establishment, on, you know, a whole host of people. I think that might have also played a role in terms of prodding other AGs to act more forcefully, going after the family specifically, not just the company.
Let's move on to the fallout of some local elections very recently. We had a lot of coverage of what happened in Bridgeport and Hartford and New Haven, some other towns and cities around the state. The primaries, of course, mean an awful lot in mayoral races, because a lot of these communities are democratically held, and the primaries are really going to say who the next mayor is going to be, but maybe not so fast in a couple of these communities, specifically Bridgeport, Paz. So State Senator Marilyn Moore, she lost to Joe Ganim in the primary, but she did not lose at the ballot box that day. She beat Mayor Ganim, not entirely handily, but certainly with some numbers. Joe Ganim won in the absentee ballot count quite handily, and so he won the primary. What recourse does Marilyn Moore have in all this, one, having to do with what happened that day, and two, can she get on the ballot in November?
Okay, let's go to the absentee ballot question. On its face, having a lopsided result to some degree is not necessarily a sign of fraud. That party organizations generally have the edge on that, They do a good job at getting people to apply, people in elderly housing complexes, whatnot. But in this case, it's crazy lopsided. And in fact, I was looking at the numbers last night. In one voting district, Joe Ghanem got more votes in absentee ballots than he did at the polls, you know, which is pretty hard to do. So the recourse for Marilyn Moore is her campaign needs to talk to as many people who cast absentee ballots. This is public information, who mm-hmm. cast them, certainly not how they filled out their ballots, and to find out what their story is. Were they aware that their absentee ballots obtained in their name and cast? And if the answer is no, then okay, you need to get a statement from them. She put out this kind of shotgun statement calling for everybody to open an investigation. That's just not the way the world works. The way it works in Connecticut is the State Elections Enforcement Commission has jurisdiction, and they require somebody to have a sworn complaint that they must attest to the best of their knowledge that they are aware of facts, if proven true, would violate state campaign laws. And I believe that's what the Moore campaign is doing, although I will tell you they've been very frustrating to deal with. I have been unable to get Senator Moore on the phone or anybody else on her campaign. But through other sources, I mean, it is my belief they are scrambling to try to find evidence that they can bring to state elections enforcement.
Before we get to the second piece of this is whether or not she can get on the ballot. Harry, one thing that I'm always interested in with this is that it seems to be the burden of this is on the candidate who lost for some reason, as opposed to on our electoral system to make sure that this gets done right in the first place. I guess I'm wondering about that when we see something that could be questionable when it comes to absentee ballots, and then we put the losing candidate basically in charge of the investigation into said problem.
Right. So I think the way – I mean, Paz is probably going to correct me here, but I think the way that it works is that Marilyn Moore's campaign has to find evidence – some evidence of something questionable going on. I think it only has to be in one case, and then bring it forward to the SEC, State Elections Enforcement Commission, and say, this is evidence that you should start an investigation. So she does have to do that initial legwork, but I think then that can trigger a state investigation.
And the commission on its own can open investigations, but they have to see something, and it has to be more than just, wow, the numbers here are startling. And by the way, this would not help Marilyn Moore this fall. What she would need to do, if they can come up with evidence, she would need to go to Superior Court, present evidence that of fraud, mm-hmm. and get a judge to order a new election. This has happened in Connecticut. In fact, it has happened in Bridgeport. It's hard to do, but so if she is going to get a new election based on absentee ballot fraud, they're going to have to move quickly.
But, it just does speak to this kind of scattershot nature of her approach to this is, you know, on the election night when she lost, she was saying, okay, hold on a second, I've lost the receipt for the signatures to get onto the ballot in November. Oh, hold on a second, maybe I can get onto somebody else's line if a third party has a line there. And now it's let's try and attack the absentee ballots. There doesn't seem to be a kind of coherent strategy or approach by the Moore campaign.
I think that might well be right. And Paz, just to close this loop very quickly then where is she with actually being able to get on the ballot in November? What else might she have to do? What else has she done already that maybe we don't know about?
Her option at this point seems to be registering as a write-in candidate. It's a difficult task, but it's become easier since Connecticut got rid of its old mechanical machines. We now have paper ballots that are scanned. So you're sitting at a table with a paper ballot. It's a hell of a lot easier than it was when Waterbury Mayor Michael Jarjour coached people on how to open a little slot at the top of a machine and write in his last name.
Mm. I just want to quickly ask, what do we know about Tony Harp's chances of getting on the ballot in New Haven? She, of course, lost the primary to Justin Elliker. A lot of party insiders who have been big supporters of Mayor Harp's for years, not just in her role as mayor, but in her political career in Connecticut, are saying, we want you to keep going and take on Justin Elliker in November. Do we know much about that?
I know what I read in the New Haven Independent. They had a meeting. Her campaign manager is certainly out. That's not surprising. Democratic operatives quite often don't stick around if it's going to be outside the party process. I don't see her path forward. The conventional wisdom, for what it's worth, was that if Justin Elliker came close in the primary, because he was on the November ballot either way, that he would certainly win in November, because you bring in, 15,000 unaffiliated voters and 2,400 Republicans. So the question for Tony Harp is, if you can't prevail among hardcore Democrats, and she lost by more than 2,000 votes, what is there to believe that she can make a better case to unaffiliated and Republican voters about a Democratic mayor than she could make to hardcore Democrats?
Oh, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to examine a literary trend that I'm fascinated by, letters to the editor about why I'm leaving Connecticut. We're talking with Mark Pazniokas, Capitol Bureau Chief of the Connecticut Mirror, Daniela Altamari, State House reporter at the Hartford Current, Harry Jones, the managing editor at Connecticut Public Radio. We'll be right back in the wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky, and in just a few moments, we're going to hear from our panelists this week about some things in the news that maybe they want to grumble about, or some feats of strength that they want to crow about. But first, let's go to something that, boy, I thought that we'd seen all of these so far, but we just have another one here. It's an op-ed in the Hartford Current, a suburban family writing about how we didn't leave Connecticut. Connecticut left us. People opining in the pages of the Current and sometimes other publications as well, that after we've put our kids through school and after we've lived a very good life in Connecticut where we've made an awful lot of money, we're going to retire someplace else where the tax structure is friendlier. Daniela, I don't know. It's hard. I mean, we've seen so many of these things. The argument is always almost exactly the same. And it feels to me like what people are saying is, I'm retiring and going to fill in the blank state, and I still am not quite sure why the rest of us need to have an op-ed about that.
Well, I'm just going to say that I've seen a lot of the criticism, most of it, I think, valid criticism, but that's beside the point. The purpose of an op-ed page is to spark discussion. I think this op-ed and discussion has been sparked, and that's probably a good thing. I mean, people have said on Twitter and elsewhere that perhaps this opinion that has been expressed many times isn't the only opinion. There are people who love Connecticut and want to stay. There are people in Connecticut who want to leave but can't because they don't have the resources or they don't have the ability to make those choices. So those are all valid points as well. But certainly, if nothing else, this piece that was printed in the Sunday op-ed page has sparked a lot of interesting discussion. So
it certainly has. I don't know. Paz, your take?
Well, you know, the Connecticut Mirror has an op-ed section. We don't do editorials. But I will say that I believe the best read opinion piece we have ever published was by Dave Walker, who wrote an explanation of, on his way out the door, what was wrong with Connecticut. And it got a huge audience. So,
wait, was one of the reasons why I left Connecticut was because I didn't win any of the elections I ran for?
I think he skipped that.
To try to run in Connecticut?
Skipped that. So, look, there's Connecticut has significant problems with its tax structure, how expensive it is. But I really loved how some people reacted to this, which is, look, it'd be far more interesting if it was a young couple who was explaining why there was no future here, why they were having trouble cracking into certain industries or there weren't jobs. And that would be a more interesting statement than two people getting to a certain age and saying, we're going to go someplace where it's cheaper. You know, that's not a new story.
Having gotten to a certain age, having had a lovely life, having, as these always say, Harriet, having educated our kids very well,
right,
having made quite a bit of money, all things I'll have you know that you can do in Connecticut. I mean, those are available pathways for many people in Connecticut to do both of those things.
So it sort of felt to me a little bit when I read it like one of those emails that you write late at night and you think you've written this, you know, and you really should show it to a friend in the morning. morning and say, does this sound too smug? Before you hit send. It's read a little bit like that. But also what it made me think of was, you know, it really spoke to the enormous demographic divide in this state. There are many people like the Vallows who wrote this op-ed who can have an amazing life here, who are among the most fortunate people on the face of the earth. There are also people in the state who are really, really, really struggling and who can't, for example, even get a decent public education for their kids, which is the state's brand, right? And I sort of wish people like the Vallows were a little bit more curious about the other people who share this state.
I think that that is well said. I will also say that something you should probably read is Susan Bigelow's piece on ctnewsjunkie.com. It's a choose-your-own-adventure. It's write your own We're Leaving Connecticut Forever opinion piece, and you can just sort of fill in the blanks. Your town here, Darien, Simsbury, Glastonbury, no matter which town you're from, you can write your own letter to the editor saying why you're leaving Connecticut after this many years of fruitful life here in the Nutmeg State. Please check out Susan's column. I'd love to talk to her about that sometime soon. Let's go to some grievances and maybe some feats of strength. Danielle, I'll start with you. What's on your mind this week?
Feats of strength, succession, if you guys are watching and speaking of the Sackler family. Such a great show. Grievance, talking about the myths and frustrations of, you know, people pegging Connecticut a certain way related to that op-ed story, op-ed piece. You know, there were a couple pieces, things that sort of percolated up over the past week that stereotype Connecticut in a very different way. That Caroline Calloway piece, where, you know, talking about this Instagram influencer who, you know, had this falling out with her friend who was ghostwriting a lot of her posts. And I mean, it was a fascinating story. But a lot of the backlash on it, people were like, I don't care about this rich person from Connecticut. And they really sort of harped on this idea that Connecticut was full of people like that. And that's a stereotype as well. And it's frustrating. You saw a little bit of it even in some of the backlash against the New York Times story on Kavanaugh over the weekend, you know, based on the book that the two reporters had written, where there was some criticism about the way one of Kavanaugh's accusers was being portrayed, you know, as this sort of working class person who went to Yale. And they're like, well, you know, people are like, she came from Connecticut. How could she be working class? And it's like, people just don't understand the state. And that's frustrating, and that's sort of a stereotype of a different kind than we were talking about with that op-ed.
Connecticut, people just don't understand us. I think it's a good slogan. Anyway, Paz, go ahead. What's in your mind?
My feat of strength is Paul Bass of the New Haven Independent.
Always,
who
every week.
Every week. But on primary night, it took his organization all of 20 minutes to completely and accurately report election results in the city of New Haven. Now, if I was a negative person, I would have done this as a grievance, and I would have mentioned that it took Hartford a day and a half to do the same. But I am not that person, so I'm going to compliment Paul Bass, who could do it in 20 minutes as opposed to the city of Hartford.
Yeah, and
registrar.
Just sending people everywhere, and that's called hyperlocal reporting. That's a very good feat of strength. Harriet, how about you?
So I don't – this is – maybe this is combined grievance and feat of strength, but I wanted to just to mark the passing and remember George Alexander Scott, who was the founder of Scott's Jamaican Bakery some four decades ago, who passed on Monday at the age of 92. The business he started is now run by his son, Gordon Scott, and they have all kinds of outlets all over the city. And it just – I think it speaks to the strength of – an immigrant experience in Hartford. And I think it's good to mark the life of George Alexander Scott.
Yeah, and it's a family that I know pretty well and that I have a very, very much affection for. So I think that that's a lovely thing to say. I will actually talk about two obits myself. It's already seemingly old news for many people in Connecticut here. But in case you haven't gotten a chance to, in case you haven't had it in your feed yet, please read the Joe Heller obit. This is a guy who lived in Connecticut who just had, in some ways, a normal life and in some ways a totally wacky life. But it actually gets to the power of writing and how someone can capture someone's life in words. And the obit that his family put together is something that is an absolute treat. And that's the sort of thing I want to read in the pages of my local newspaper when it comes to an opinion about a life. The other life, of course, I want to talk about is that of Cokie Roberts, the longtime NPR and NBC political reporter and commentator. I am one of those many people who got a chance to cross paths with her. I will obviously miss her voice and her intelligence, but she was really incredibly kind to me. She was really kind and very supportive to many people who are colleagues of mine and friends of mine who've worked in the system of National Public Radio. So thank you, Cokie, for a life well-lived. I want to thank Katie Talarski for producing our program, Colin Wolf, our technical producer. Thanks so much to our panelists today, Daniel Altomare from the Hartford Current, Harriet Jones from Connecticut Public Radio, Mark Pasniokas from the Connecticut Mirror. Thanks so much for listening to The Wheelhouse.